the ball rolling, maybe you could talk a little bit about who was represented on this cruise from the science community, perhaps a little bit about the scope of the studies that took place and the variety of disciplines that were involved. If that's something that you feel you're able to do.
No, very much so. Some of this is a little redundant to things that you've seen already, including the publication outline that came out as an approved document, mm-hmm. and some of our earlier conversations, but just in case, let me start from scratch here.
Okay.
There have been many people over the years that recognized the need for detailed studies of the Arctic Ocean and surrounding land masses and overarching atmosphere with regard to a variety of issues, including global change, just a basic understanding of our planet, how it functions, what its history has been, what its future is likely to be. When those people and organizations looked at what we have and what we can do and where we need to go with these studies, they realized straight up that overall, the human race is limited in its logistical capability for doing Arctic research, basic research. From the U.S. side, I would say we're particularly limited in what we can do. Now, that's not to say we don't have logistical capability, but for the most part, that capability is limited to nearshore regions during specific times of the year when the ice and weather conditions allow people to be out there doing work. Even with the ships that we have, surface vessels that could go out there, we're pretty limited to where we can go and when we can be there. Okay. But in the meanwhile, understanding the Arctic region requires year-round observations and synoptic observations of the entire area. Okay. So again, with the recognition that one of the primary impediments to doing these kinds of studies is logistics, and being aware that we do have a capability, a rather significant capability, from a Department of Defense capability to maneuver in the Arctic under ice using submarines, people sought those resources as a logistics support capability. And this has, for the first time ever, been made available to the scientific research community for basic open published research. Now, I went through that description just to point up an important difference. Research has gone on in the Arctic for many years using submarines, but it was research specific to Department of Defense interests, and almost all of it, a great deal of it, has been classified. And what we need to do is to get that information made available. There are two areas that are going on. One is environmental scientists with security clearances have been looking at currently classified data sets to find out what of those data sets would be valuable and whether those data sets could be made available in one form or another for evaluation. And then what we're looking at is the acquisition of primary new data that is specifically directed towards pressing areas of interest. And as I said, this is the first time ever that we've had ships available to do unclassified research. And we took that opportunity. It was made available rather suddenly, even though we've been at it for a couple of years. In January of this year, we heard that we were likely to get a vessel. It wasn't certain at first. And so that drew, or entrained, really, a process. There's a group that is known as UNOLS, UNOLS, or if I can get this now, University National Oceanographic Laboratory Systems, I think.
And when you refer to we being apprised in January that we would have this vessel, you're referring to this group here?
Yes, the okay. science community in general. And then it became a matter of, since this is non-traditional, there really wasn't a pathway that we could go, but as I said, there have been a population of interested people. And the idea then was to make it available to the general U.S. science community for research. And what that brought up was the question of, well, who within the U.S. science community would be interested in using such a vessel, what kinds of capabilities do we collectively have, and how might we establish some priorities on what's the best way to use the vessel, and where should it go? And I would say that this was a totally open process. At various times, there were probably 40 U.S. scientists from different institutions involved in the deliberations. And they put together a program that was not specific to any discipline, but was really oriented towards the Arctic Ocean, its adjoining seas, and whatever could be done with a fast turnaround that did not include modifying the vessel significantly. Mm-hmm. And because there were rather severe limitations on the number of people that could go, there was an effort to find qualified researchers from five primary science disciplinary areas to go and represent their respective communities. So they really weren't doing research for themselves. They were being representatives of broader groups of people, mm-hmm. and institutions. Mm-hmm. And of course, when one starts to look at these things, certain institutions stand forward as being those primarily involved in polar, more specifically Arctic research. And the University of Alaska Fairbanks is one that stands clearly mm-hmm. Out in a selection process like that. So we wound up with the five disciplinary areas being geophysics for geological oceanography, physical oceanography, chemical oceanography, biological oceanography, and sea ice cover and dynamics. And there were people chosen to fill into those spots, and it represented two from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, myself, doing primarily chemical oceanography and some biological. Peter McRoy from University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Marine Sciences, doing biological marine sciences. Jamie Morrison from the University of Washington as a physical oceanographer. Roger Colony from the University of Washington looking at ice cover. And Bernie Coakley of Lamont Earth Observatory, Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Used to be Geological Observatory, they just changed their name. Doing geophysical studies using gravity measurements. And so we then were each representing a variety of people, and I think collectively there were something like 20 investigators from quite a number of institutions whose science was in one way or another represented. For example, within the chemical oceanography, which also had a significant biological component that I and Peter McRoy represented, we had, of course, University of Alaska Fairbanks, Peter McRoy, Larry Duffy was interested in the program, and there were a few others who may or may not take advantage of that. There were three investigators from Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory interested in chemical components. Peter Schlosser was looking at helium and tritium to look at the age and circulation of the ocean. Bill Smithy was looking at coral chlorofluorocarbons, again as an indication of ocean circulation and whatnot. And Ray Sambrotto, formerly a student and graduate of UAF, who was interested in total CO2. Peter McRoy, I mentioned, was interested primarily in nutrients, oxygen, and he was representing a few other people as well. And then we had Lee Cooper, formerly graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who's now at Oak Ridge National Laboratory doing stable oxygen isotopes. Tim Hollibaugh from San Francisco State University interested in bacterial populations. Farouk Azam from Scripps Institution of Oceanography interested in bacterial populations, genetic material from bacteria and marine viruses. And Osmond Holmhansen from Scripps Institution of Oceanography interested in phytoplankton. Hmm. So it was a rather complete program, and if I had more time and you were interested, I could tell you all of the other people interested in physical and whatnot. But it was a group, I think, of about 20 investigators and probably more than a dozen institutions.
That were represented. Perhaps at some point we can discuss how the process was arrived at to allow these studies to be so comprehensive that all of these researchers could benefit from it. But for right now, maybe you can just talk a little bit about, in generic terms, whether or not you thought the cruise was a success. When you first went out, some of the things that you would be looking at were employing upward-looking echo sounders for measurements of ice, and looking at some of the other aspects that you just talked about, physics, chemistry. So do you think that based on what you know from the cruise, that it was a successful mission?
Yeah, success is an interesting term, because it implies a complete knowledge of what went on and what will result from the samples. I think it needs to be divided into two pieces. One is, were you able to accomplish what you set out to do for the cruise? And that involved collection of water samples and of raw data sets. And that's an absolutely unqualified yes. It was terrifically successful. We developed some novel equipment that had never been tested or employed before, and it worked marvelously well. Now, we had to do a little twiddling around with it in order to make it work, but all of that was to be expected, and it worked out fine, and we never lost a station because of the way that the equipment worked. We, during the course of this thing, traversed, I think, more than 4,000 miles of ocean tract. We occupied all of the stations that we had originally planned on making.
Excuse me, what do you mean employed all the stations? Okay.
The ship, of course, can work in the Arctic because it travels under ice, underwater. Okay. And the ship is exquisitely designed to do a variety of measurements while it's underwater. That's the way it's designed. What we wanted to do was to use the vessel to get us to particular places so that we could come to the surface and use traditional oceanographic techniques to collect water samples at depth and to carry those samples back for analyses. Some analyses were done on board, on site, but for the most part, we bottled them, captured them, and then preserved them so that people can analyze them later. And we occupied more surface sites than were originally planned. I think ultimately we occupied 20 sample stations. At 18 of those stations, we, through the use of remote winches, so we sent down water collecting devices, we sampled to 400 meters, and we collected in total 1,900 water samples that will be sent all around the U.S. for analyses. We also, using a variety of equipment, some of which would normally be part of the ship's instruments and some that were used on the ship, we were able to almost continuously record information on ice draft, which is the amount of ice that extends below the surface of the water. And from that, people can extrapolate to ice volume and total ice volume. We also collected information on the magnetics of the Earth, which is an indication of what the composition of the ocean bottom is. And then we also had things that measured salinity by looking at conductivity and temperature, and a variety of other parameters.
Okay. Well, when I asked you whether it was a successful mission or not, you kind of lead into my next question, and that had to do with when would we be in a position to be able to decipher all this raw data and get a sense of what it means.
Okay. Again, these are complicated issues. When the samples get to the laboratories and people can free up their time in order to analyze them, I suspect they're going to be given high priority, but each lab is a different story. A number of things will come out. One is the quality of the sample sufficient to allow good analyses to be done, and some of these things are very complex, and the samples can be damaged in a number of different ways. We won't know that until all of the analyses are run. So individual investigators will gather individual components of these things, and then they will collaborate amongst themselves so that they start to combine data sets into meaningful packages. For example, the people that are looking at total CO2, this is a laboratory at Lamont Doherty, need corroborative information, including the oxygen measurements that Peter McRoy made, along with observations on pigments and nutrients, the salinity measurements that Jamie Morrison made at Washington in order to look at water column structure, and a variety of other things. And they will start to write these packages up in a way that will make some sense to the reviewing community. Ultimately, many of these data sets will be combined into a comprehensive document and will be published to give a synoptic look of, mm-hmm. of the that part of the ocean mm-hmm. we looked at. And I suspect that could be months away, maybe more than a year. It's hard to know. It depends on how these data are dealt with.
Okay.
And oftentimes the data will be combined with other historical data that we have in order to try to make more of a picture out of what we know about seasonal interannual variation as well as depth and geographic variation.
And also, when I asked you whether it was a success, you said your response was, well, success is an interesting term. And you said, from the standpoint of did we meet our objective of going out and getting the data, yes, it was unequivocally a success. That answer implies that there's a second part to that response, and maybe you can give that.
And that is, are the samples and the data that we collected good? And so if it turns out that Bill Smithy, looking at chlorofluorocarbons, analyzes his water samples and realizes that because of the refrigeration mechanic who was trying to repair, and this is actually the case, continuously repair the ice cream machine, contaminated the internal atmosphere of the ship with CFCs, then perhaps we have a problem. We took more steps than you have time to listen to make sure that that wasn't mm-hmm. the case, but we won't know it till the analyses are run. So, and in that case, of course, if they were terrible samples, then one would say, no, it wasn't very successful. But I think that we were out to do a number of things on this cruise. One was to collect the data and the samples mm-hmm. and to bring them back to represent our communities. The other was to find out how well the academic community would interface with the submarine service personnel and how well suited the vessel was to this kind of study. And I think we got a lot of insight into that. And again, I would have to say that based on my experience, I would say that submarines are superb vessels and offer unique opportunities to study the Arctic Ocean, and we need to pursue this actively.
Okay.
We need to create an environment where, in a well-planned for way, the U.S. science community would be able to anticipate the availability and to formulate integrated research programs on those vessels into the years that are going to be coming.
Have you heard any feedback on how that may work into the Navy's plans? This is the first ever. And
yes. I think that our trip from the Navy side, this is again from the information that I currently have, was viewed as a great success. Certainly our interactions with the captain of the ship, of the USS Fargo, his officers and the crew were terrific. It couldn't have been better. Clever, creative people, including the science complement, putting their collective skills together to achieve an end. We all worked well together. There was really no friction, and everything went exceedingly well. I think that was successful. I think the Navy sees an opportunity to direct its equipment and personnel in a useful direction, and that could work out very well. I'm optimistic. And I think really at this point in time, the onus is on the U.S. science community to think collectively about what needs to be done, how it could be accomplished using this vessel, these kinds of vessels actually, and put forward a series of plans for how to achieve their needs for the future and then to deal with the Navy in a constructive way. And I think there will always be a certain need to deal with the fact that this is a DoD asset that has certain classification issues, certain issues that will remain classified associated with them, and to work in a way that allows for the best of both of these communities to come together.
Mm-hmm. You talked about being with this crew and how great it was to work with them. You traveled some 4,000 miles?
It's more than that. It's more like 8,000 by the 8, time we got there and got back. Yes.
Is that right? 20 days, 8,000 miles.
Mm-hmm. And
any cases of cabin fever?
Well, it turned out to be 6 weeks long. We were on site for 20 days. We had to get there, and that took a while.
Oh.
And then we had to get back from there, and that took a longer while, it seemed. We were gone 6 weeks, and we got along very well with the crew and amongst ourselves. 6 weeks is a long time to be doing anything. One of the interesting aspects of a submarine is that it's a really small space. Okay, matter of fact, I have never seen such a dense compaction of equipment and people in one spot in my entire life. I mean, these things are dense. And the amount of personal space is pretty much non-existent. It was, for our purposes, limited to bunks that were 26 inches wide, 6 feet long, 18 inches high. And some members of the crew really didn't even have that luxury, in that they shared the same sleeping space, not simultaneously, but serially. And so they would have 8 hours in that space, and then they would be replaced by someone else. And I really...
I bet your double bed or your queen bed felt good when you got back.
Yeah, and so it gives one a real appreciation for personal space and what it means. But
I guess.
These are people who are very busy, and I think that commitment and that level of work helps to make the time pass very fast.
Is it classified for us to know what the complement of the crew was? I know there were, wasn't it, 7 civilian scientists on board?
That's right. There were, well, actually 5 civilian scientists and 2 people from the Arctic Submarine Laboratory, which acted as facilitators, and these were people with scientific backgrounds, but they were primarily there to ease our way into submarine life and to make sure that the ship came to station and to
and
help us with
those. These are Navy scientists of the Arctic?
They're actually civilians now, but they were formerly with the military and in the submarine service.
Okay.
They act as ice pilots.
Okay. And then the Navy crew itself?
Well, it was more than 120 people, I believe.
Whoa,
yeah.
Really?
Right.
Including you, or in addition?
No, I think that we may have been in addition to that. We pressed the limit of the ship considerably. Not just because of our warm bodies, but because of our needs.
And were they, by and large, a crew of younger people, older people?
I have read someplace, and I really don't know the truth of this, but that the average age went from 17 to 25 years. I know people there were older than that,
mm-hmm.
but that is an average. It was, for the most part, younger people. Of course, when you get into the officers' ranks and chief petty officers and whatnot, they tend to be somewhat more senior.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very young group of people.
And did you have much downtime, or was it all data collecting and research and science?
the secret to success when we weren't involved in scientific study was trying to stay out of the way. And all of the passageways and the ladders and the various spaces were small, and they're meant for timeshare, in that everybody was moving all of the time. So there wasn't anything like a desk space that we could occupy, or setting up a computer for much more than an hour if you were lucky and there wasn't a drill being run or some other activity to take over that space was pretty unusual. And as I said, one of the luxuries that we had, and the only personal space, was our bunks. And so oftentimes when we were underway but not involved in science, but they had drills that they were running or educational programs which went on nonstop, it was really quite a bookish group. I think that accounts nicely for their super qualification in almost every area, is that they were continually studying rehearsing, relearning, and being tested on whatever it was that was their task on the ship, and all of them tended to be multiply tasked. They covered various areas. But whenever we weren't on station, we were basically moving towards our bunks just to get out of the way.
18 inches is not a whole heck of a lot of space.
The reality is, this is no BS. 26 inches wide.
No,
I forget, the 6 feet almost to the, you know, fraction of an inch for the length. 18 inches from the top of the mattress to the ceiling for about the first 2/3 of your body length. And the bottom part, then there were little lockers and various kinds of ducting and whatnot, so that the space wound up being about 12 inches from the top of the mid leg to the toes.
No effing way would you get me to do that. They're like stacked four higher.
They're shelves. They're three high. Beneath each bunk is a place where you put all of your worldly goods must fit within a 4-inch deep by 26-inch deep by 6-foot long.
I get claustrophobic just thinking about it.
And my bunk, just for point of reference, was the third one up, which means that you have to grab onto some steel struts and kind of do a leg up into these things. And the first week we were out, I sprained my back.
Oh, jeez. Well, is there like a chow hall that you...
Yeah, there's a dining area. There's a cruise mess, which is... a very small space, but all of the space on the ship is very cleverly designed. And I have to say, without much regard for the human occupant of the ship, and you know, ergonomics and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. but there is absolutely not a wasted cubic inch on the ship. Everything has multiple uses, and you know, you'd find little lockers and storage spaces and chairs and desks that pull out everywhere you turn around. But within this dining facility, which also served as classroom, where they held their religious services every Sunday, where the group got a chance to see videotapes. I mentioned lectures, but in addition to that were other kinds of study operations and testing. All of those things happened in the same space, and then the officers had a ward room, which was smaller, about 25% of that size. And the same kind of thing happened, but at a different level in the hierarchy there. And these things were basically occupied 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by one thing or another. And the other thing that I found to be really interesting was, it's probably true since the first maritime expedition, when you're going off for a long period of time, carrying enough food for that many people becomes mm-hmm. really a big deal. And so they had freezers that were jammed wall to wall, floor to ceiling with stuff. And then the food is all contained in cans that are about 8 inches in diameter and 10 inches high. And those are placed on the floors all around the passageways. And the passageways originally only have a floor-to-ceiling thing. It's roughly 6 feet, maybe a tiny bit more. When you put cans in there, and they are narrow anyway, it means that you've got to basically stoop and duck walk through all of these things because you literally walk on next week's meal.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And what about just exercising or trying to stretch your legs and get some movement?
They had a Nordic track and a barbell and push-up bars, and occasionally people could find places to chin up and do sit-ups.
And did they take advantage of that?
Oh yeah. The Nordic track was in use quite a lot of the time, and of course when it was up and operational, when it was down it was really put away someplace. When it was up and operational, it plugged up one of the major thoroughfares, so as the skis were going back and forth, you had how do you call it, double scotch? Like hopscotch jump rope?
Huh.
You had to do a quick hop, skip, and a jump to get between these things, which had somebody working them all the time, and then when it was done, usually it would be operated for a half hour at a time, and it would get put away.
Hmm. Fascinating. Well, I'll just wrap up. I wanted to just go back real quickly. You talked about collectively the science community getting together and trying to perhaps set some priorities for future use of these types of vessels for research. Oh. Are you optimistic that something like that could happen? And if so, why? What would be the benefit for the U.S. Navy when there's such a federal budget crisis, if you will? Is this something that the Navy could afford to do? How would we pay for something like this?
Well, one could approach that kind of a question from a variety of different points of view. Now, I'll use my own, but I realize that it's not unique.
Well, the most important one, of course.
These ships are not owned by the Navy, they're owned by the people of the United States. Okay. The Navy clearly operates them and should continue to operate them. We were traveling on a Sturgeon-class attack submarine, which is getting to be a rather older ship. There have been a couple of newer models that have come out since. And these things are, well, the USS Pargo, I understand, was 25 years old, but it still has a fair amount of life in it, if we wish to use it. And what I think needs to occur here is for the U.S. Navy to continue to operate these vessels, but to direct at least a portion of their activities towards supporting basic research in the Arctic. The rest of the time, when they're not doing that, then they could, should engage in naval operations. That's what they're designed for, and designed very well, I might add. The value that comes from that is that by keeping these things around, they provide a service which is viewed by many as being essential. We don't have an alternative to this, really. Mm-hmm. And there is a well-stated need to continue to do this. So it becomes
continuous that there is a well-documented and generally acknowledged statement that global change research is a national priority, and we need to pursue it. And that within the context of global change, that the Arctic is a key, important element, and one that we need to understand if we're going to make more sense out of the modeling and the predictions that are being made. Submarines offer a unique opportunity to be able to gather that, and so I think that the Navy recognizes and is prepared to respond to that national priority by making these vessels available and the crews that operate them available. Now, I think there are other value that accrues to this. On the one side, it provides yet another rationale for keeping a strong naval force going. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so it gives an opportunity to keep another ship of the fleet operational with a good reason. It is good for crew training. It is good for the development of under ice submarine capability. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that if the science community recognizes this as an important asset, and if Congress is prepared to see to it that monies are made available for the operation of the ship and the funding of the basic research, okay, both of these things need to be paid attention to, that we can pull together an agreement that these ships will be made available in a predictable fashion for the future. And I think that's clearly important to the nation.
Okay. That answers my question. Thank you. All right. I think I got everything that I need.
And then so. I mentioned that we only learned about this in January, and that there were incredible, really, sacrifices on the part of a lot of people to put it together at the last minute. And those sacrifices are not only amongst the scientists, but within the Navy as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of well-meaning people put a huge amount of effort into making this thing happen, and they need to get a round of applause. Within that context, because of the short notice, it was impossible for us to go out for the kind of financial support that we normally would seek to mm-hmm. undertake these kinds of expeditions. And as a result of that, certain institutions, and I think most noteworthy, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, made major contributions in time of people as well as real expenditures of money in order to see to it that it occurred. And to my mind, acknowledgement needs to go out to the fact that the University of Alaska Fairbanks, along with the University of Washington and Lamont Doherty, as well as a few other institutions, really contributed in a significant way to this thing. The Arctic Research Commission of the U.S. This also had the sponsorship of Senator Stevens, who encouraged the development of this thing, and Murkowski. and that did I mention the Arctic Research Commission?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then those kinds of things, I think, really kind of mm-hmm. need a little bit of a
sure.
boost. Okay, so we were more than just passive participants. We actively made it occur.
When you mentioned Senator Stevens' Inside Edition,
have been described for the most part by visitors. The people who come to another land and then bring that description to the outside world have been in the hands of explorers or colonialists or, you know, usually white male, you know, type people. And that's created images of other people that often they're totally inaccurate, they're loaded with biases, and there may not at all be how people there themselves see themselves. And, you know, the idea here is to try to figure out a way for people to better represent themselves in this powerful image-making process. Or, not powerful is probably not a good word, but to find a way for people to more represent themselves in this pervasive image-making process, because it's everywhere. Now, it's really important, huh? Let me keep going. It's real important that this is not the only answer. You know, what we propose here, you know, having people produce their own videos, and they're loaded with biases and, you know, their own view and everything, just as an outsider is. But what we're hoping we can do with this is to have sort of a mosaic of views, so that she's just not seeing the world through one set of eyes. You know, the traveler's eyes, the documentarian's eyes, but looking at the, you know, a people in a place through multiple sets of eyes. So it's, one is not, you know, just turning the cameras over to people and say, do it yourself. That's not maybe any better than a white male colonialist coming in. It probably is a lot better, but you know, I mean, there are pros and cons, and they're kind of two extremes. And what we're doing is we're trying to find a way to bring it together so that you get a multiple, you know, kind of like this mosaic idea, that you can see, you know, you can see images of Siberia through Siberian eyes, the way they want themselves shown. And then you can also compare that with literature that you read, and you can see it through documentaries that were starting to come out. But it all makes up a composite picture. We're not arguing that there's only one way to do it. You know, we're just looking for other ways to do it. So that we can make programs that are different.
I don't want to stray too far, but in an era of mass communication where we have so much coming at us,
mm-hmm.
how isn't that information already available? Are we not getting multiple pictures of different cultures?
No, we get the classic traveler's view of things, for the most part. Most documentary productions about, you know, the National Geographics or the things that we see that really take us to other places are produced by people who have somewhat of the same training, who are from a white dominant culture, that are usually playing to an American audience, and they produce programs in a specific way to do that. And it eliminates certain things because it doesn't play to the big audience. And so most of what we see are filtered through that sort of homogenous set of standards, set of eyes.
No matter Siberia or anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, stuff that we come from Siberia, you know, ABC just had a Siberian program on, and it was highly dramatic. It was, you know, it had all the elements of a Monday night movie. Well, you know, it told a compelling story. But what do the people there, how do they see themselves? How do they want themselves portrayed? That's the question we're getting at. we're using this new technology, lightweight small cameras, to try to find ways of getting these other views, the view of, you know, the people who live there.
Do they have a say in the people? Do they have a say in how it's put together in the end? And they're filming, but do they have a say?
Yeah, we brought an editing bench too, and they edited them.
So they were also deciding what to keep and what to throw away.
Yeah.
So they're involved in the entire process.
Yeah, the documentary that we're going to see on KVC is sort of a composite of all their films. But one of the films by one of the people just won an award at a film festival. Their first film. They did a very good job. But this is kind of getting, I mean, I don't know, are we talking about this program, or are we talking about the ideals of the research?
I do want to cover the whole big picture, and this Siberia through Siberian Eyes will be your focus. Pretty much, but I do want to at least address those issues and maybe talk about a little bit about them. And then bring it back to UAF. How is this important to the particular studies that are already being done here at UAF? I know you're working with Eliza, and she was with Alaska Native Language Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so, is this something that they've already done without using the technology that you're doing?
Well, it kind of goes into the theory of anthropology when people are looking at what's called a crisis of representation. Who has the right to represent another culture? And anthropologists and people like that have been looking at this for about a decade now.
Are you aware of any studies that are being done in the area?
With
Alaska Native Language. I mean, how will it contribute to the cross-cultural studies that are being done?
Well, yeah, Eliza, of course, is someone who, our work with McPherson the Raven was on the Kaikab River, and Eliza is an expert, and she's my advisor. And what we wanted to do there is to try to find a way to measure the quantifiably the success or the weaknesses of what we called community collaborative production. And in that project, we had a panel of people from the villages that oversaw the whole project from beginning to end. They were in control. It's very different, very unusual. And so we've heard that people were very, very happy with them. And I've heard that, but you never know. You never know whether that's just being, you know, people being nice. There's no way to measure it. So what we did with this grant is we proposed that we would go out and conduct some focus groups and design a survey instrument that would try to assess how people really felt about these programs so that we could analyze, you know, how we did them and whether it worked or not.
Is part of what the cross-cultural base, Alaska Native Language Center, or the Center for Cross-Cultural Education, will they gain, like, perhaps methods
mm-hmm.
of assessing?
Mm-hmm.
Is that their
what we're going? Yeah. What we're thinking in terms of a broader application is collaborative research, methods of collaborative research. which has also been around for a long time. But this is a study that looks at just how people, how they feel they were treated in this process, and how they were depicted to the outside world. You know, we told, you know, more people have seen, have learned about Koyukon Athabascan people through these programs than a lot of people knew about Athabascans in general. You know, so these made an impression on people, you know, both, you know, to citizens in the United States, because it played in Britain, it's played in the United States, it's played all over the place, Canada. It's really been seen by millions and millions of people. So that's a big thing. And so are people, do they think they were accurately represented? And, you know, is this the way they wanted to be shown to the outside world? And we needed to find that out. You know, we hear it from bits and pieces, but we wanted to know, is this, can we say for sure that people thought that when we showed this, that was the act, you know, that was truly the way it is, and it, stuff like that. And that's what we're trying to pick apart from it, so that we can do it again, possibly, but also share the experience with other places. For villages, really. You know, I mean, it has applications in terms of academics, but it also has direct applications to other communities who wish to do something similar.
Okay. And that all sort of, does it get finally umbrellaed under the Center for Cross-Cultural Studies, or do they use this information? Do they?
Well, no, we're pretty independent of that. We're doing this from a communications, you know, production.
So it doesn't really affect it too much.
Mm-mm.
What happens?
Okay. It'll be interesting data for them, I'm sure. It's already turning out to be interesting. We're loading the computer now, and it's turned out to be pretty. They really do like them. And what's amazing about it is that we can't claim credit for it. We cannot claim credit for those programs. They belong to people there. They are the ones that have the credit, that where the credit's due. So, I mean, well, I was lucky enough to have something to do with it. They're not me. I mean, when I see the success of them, I don't say that it's our success. I say, well, you know, my success, I think it's the success of people willing to share. And that's pretty neat. It's nice to see that system can be set up so that people can feel satisfied when it's all over.
Now, have the people who edited their pieces, are they finished? Was that part successful for them?
Well, it's really interesting because now we've had our second year follow-up, and people are still shooting, even though Russia is under extreme duress. People are still shooting. Two people that were in the seminar. See, we train people for, mm-hmm. you know, and they, two of them have won film festival awards. Two of them are enrolled in advanced degree programs in ethnography. And one received a scholarship to enter the Moscow Film School. So, that's really, it's been a kind of a personal benefit to them. And it all blends together. We're, you know, it's so hard to kind of pick these things apart. I mean, if you take one of our documentaries, it's paid for by KUAC, you know. It's paid for by viewers, you know. But yet, we're kind of piggybacking on, you know, these research awards.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to make the research accessible to the researched. We're trying to make the product of our research understandable and accessible to a general, you know, a general interested audience. And that's another goal that we have with all this, is that we don't necessarily produce a research that is so specialized that it sits on a shelf, but that we can turn around and apply it immediately into how we produce programs. That's how we try to. This is the thing we're trying, and so far it's working. I mean, first one out of the chute will be Siberia Through Siberian Eyes.
Okay, so the first thing you're doing is letting the people who are the subject matter be a play part in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing you're doing is taking those things and how you do it,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not it's successful.
Yeah, going back and analyzing
to
it.
To use it to create my program.
Yeah.
So right. Just a revolving door.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Siberia, we trained people how to produce their own stuff, their own ethnographic video, and with theory and practical. And then they ended up producing a self-portrait of their village, a self-portrait of Kazin.
Was a lot different than things like Commit First to the Raven.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There won't be anything like this. I mean, this has never been done before. Simply said, in literature, nobody has done this. UAF has a leadership role in specifically Northern Communications, but in producing ethnographic records that have heavy community involvement. You know, Lenny and Sarah at the film, at the museum. I mean, UAF has a tradition here of producing programs with the people, you know, in strong collaborative relationships that don't exist in other places. But what's really completely new is to take the technology to the field, to the place, and say, here, we'll give you some basics. What is it you want to express to the rest of the world? With these ethnographic criteria, not home movies, not, you know, take the camera and go fishing with it, but having these sets of standards that they can understand are what you know, what make an ethnographic record. And that, you know, there have been experiments with other, using small format video in other places, like in South America, but they really worked for political means. And this was, you know, I mean, there were conflict resolution and other kinds of things like that. But this is the only one, to our knowledge, that really has a mission of learning more about other people through, you know, the principles of ethnography, for example.
Now, in your article, your paper, two questions. One, did you steer them away from political matters?
We tried, but ethnography is really, it's laden with politics. But we tried. We were there pre-coup. The federal government was very concerned that we not go over there and try to create, a problem and give tools to people that they could create problems with. But, you know, once in the hands of people, they will do what they want to do. Politics, the political action was not a priority for us. You know, the people who were involved were cultural leaders, and they had political agendas. But we kept saying, look, the point of this is, how can you teach other people about who you are by using this video technology? It's not journalism.
Steered them away indirectly.
Yeah, but now what they've done since then is another story. I got a tape the other day that was just wonderful. It's out on the back of a reindeer sled going through the black, or a little scrub miniature like dwarf forest. Mile after mile of this reindeer taking us through the forest. And you come up to a tent, you know, a Yakutian tent, the smoke coming out of the top. It's obviously very, very cold, 25 below zero or colder. You go into the tent, people are sitting around reading literature, and they start talking about how the land was raped by the gold miners. So in this packaging of purely ethnographic, classic imagery, you get right into the core of it, right in the heart, and it's political, you know. So you can't really separate.
Another thing I noticed was that you said something like, once they realized that the impact, what they were doing, that it was going to be seen by
mm-hmm.
Athabascans, Eskimos in Alaska, and also Yukon Territory, you know, very wide range, then they felt a little bit differently about it,
mm-hmm.
and what they were doing.
Yeah, they became more self-conscious and aware that people were going to be judging who they were by how they did it. And that was that shifted things too.
So does that create a bias on what they do?
No question.
They would show the world?
No question. And that's where some people would argue, well, that's the role of, that's why we have social scientists. So that they can come in and be more neutral in how this stuff, they supposedly are, you know, just passionate and detached from the political scene.
So I guess my question was that by the time that people are steered away from certain subject matter, and then they're also aware of the impact, is that as close as you can get?
No.
Is it not watered down to some extent?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely watered down in that sense. In that context, it is. But in the context of this other thing that I just talked about with the gold mining, those people were speaking from the heart. They were not trying to speak to an American audience. They were speaking to anyone who would listen. You know, help. This is what's going on. One of the other groups of people went to a camp where their parents live. And it's a very different kind of ethnographic record than we would see if I were shooting it. It's very, very different. Because they're singing and laughing. You know, it's very different. So, it's not the sole answer. Just, that needs to be really emphasized. This is not like, oh my God, we've just discovered that this is the truth. Well, that's not the case. But what we're looking at ways of finding other ways to not be so dominating in how we create the images of other people.
Do you think the impact is yet to come?
Mm.
What, like you said, what's coming out of their mouth,
yeah.
Whereas you guys are pretty much wrapped up.
Yeah, we want to do another seminar. We want to do another seminar in Siberia, and we want to do another one in Alaska. And, excuse me, and see what evolves. I think that we're onto something. I think that Siberia through Siberian eyes will show that people are very capable of producing their own programs. That's not a fair statement to say. That the images that people create are very interesting. Now, whether it hits the diet needs of the American public is another story. Because it's not high-laden drama, you know, things like that. There are shortcomings in terms of the consumer. But in terms of their proficiency of technology and all that, it's very good. So I think that we could push further and explore further. And how could we set up sort of relationships with people that they are producing their programs with us so that we provide an outside view when necessary, they provide the inside view, and that when we watch a program, we're seeing more of a cross-section rather than that solo view or that univu view.
Can maybe the two things be blended?
Mm-hmm. We try to do a bit of that in this program.
One quick question. And you've answered this probably a little bit already, how does Siberia through Siberian Eyes differ from productions like the First Sea Raven or productions that you've seen done about in the past? I mean, what's the number one thing that you see? Is it the lack of sensationalism or enemies or something else there that's... Mm. Are they just comparing apples to oranges?
Well, I mean, the biggest difference superficially, right off the bat, is that it has a... that we're seeing a multiple views. Because in the seminar, there were 13 students, all of which produced their own finished program. Well, by the very nature, you're going to have varying views of what they are, of what they wanted to show. The second thing is, I think that they... that we are in a time when people need to be empowered with the technology and access to represent themselves. And it should be our job to help that process. And I guess the third thing, the last thing is that it was very interesting to see how the ideology of the people affected the programs. You know, the what they thought was important and under what sort of burden they've lived, how that is so different. One of the programs is about an 85-year-old babushka. She worked 18 and a half years in the coal mines. She had to give her three children up to orphanages. She was thrown out of a school because her parents were, her father was a priest. She's living alone. And the student did a film about the day in the life of this woman. And she told all that story. Dostoevsky type story.
Now, is this something that would be...
It's in Siberia. You'll
see it.
Else. Yeah.
So is it... Are they short little mini videos?
Yeah. The program is about the idea of the seminar. And, well, it's actually, I think the film is about Siberia.
Do you not get to see each student's work, or do you?
Yeah. Then we say, we tell a little bit about the background of how Siberia was Sovietized, which really had a huge impact on people. Nobody really knows that, I think. You don't know too much about it?
No. In fact, I thought that they were isolated from the whole political.
Oh, God, no. They came in.
See, that's something that's been, you know, kind of just because I don't know, you know. If I had no idea that they would be as political, I figured they just did their reindeer thing and that was...
Yeah, no.
Because that's what you see on television.
Yeah, see? See? And so given the chance, they didn't talk, because we were there during the coup, they were not going to say, hey, save us, save us. But
no, Mark, you were kind enough to walk through the process for me about what is the different categories for the contest, and maybe we could start again with that so that I understand what's going on here. Now, your team was an award-winning team, and your other two mates aren't here. That's
right,
Dane and
right,
Kendrick.
They, right.